Roger Bingham. I direct the Science Network, and seven years ago, I actually sat down with Jim to do a conversation like this. Much has happened in the interim. But this is an extraordinary day. He's done lots of things, but let me just focus on the two things. There's a wonderful journalist and scientist called Matt Ridley, who's a friend of ours, who was asked some questions about Jim some time ago, and he said, I think he has twin places in history, as a discoverer of the double helix and as writer of the double helix. So we're talking about DNA, obviously. Let me give you some dates to set this up so that you have some sort of a context for all of this. My understanding is that the actual discovery was 28 February 1953.
Yeah.
And then the paper in Nature, a very short paper in Nature, was on the 25th of April, 1953. So we're DNA at 60. The double helix itself, the book, was published in 1968. And just this year, there's a new version, a huge, wonderful, annotated version, an illustrated version of the double helix, edited by Alex Gann and Jan Witkowski from Cold Spring Harbor Labs, which I strongly recommend you to take a look at. It says here there's a review in Science by Nathaniel Comfort, who's at the Institute of History of Medicine at Johns Hopkins, and he'll give you some sense. He said that the original double helix, he said Wilson's character is anything, it was originally supposed to be called Honest Jim. He says, Watson's character is anything but honest. He's the quintessential unreliable narrator. He's saying this nicely. Crick never understood this, and nor did he grasp that independent of its historical accuracy, the double helix is profoundly true. He could not see that it's a sardonic, platonic, shoulder-chucking love letter from his partner, and it blasted the stuffy, gentlemanly heroism of popular stereotype, making laboratory life seem playful, naughty, and, well, cool. So, here we are, 60 years after DNA, and Jim's moved on to other things. But let me begin by asking you, giving you this comment that I mentioned to you last night. It's a quote from Lewis Thomas. In a wonderful volume of essays called The Medusa and the Snail. And Lou said that the capacity to blunder slightly is the real marvel of DNA. Without this special attribute, we would still be anaerobic bacteria and there would be no music. The seminal discovery, I mean, I think the reason that there's so much attention being paid to this is that it all this time of forms of life on this planet, and it's only in the last 60 years that we've figured out the structure of life. And I welcome you again. It's wonderful to see you again to talk about the marvelous molecule. Take me back, if you would. Let's do a little history first of how you got into all of this business and what drove you to even think about going into science.
My Uncle Tom gave me a book on birds. It was called Traveling with Birds, on bird migration, for Christmas when I was 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he did so knowing my father had been an obsessive bird watcher early in his youth and had to give it up. And now, you know, with a son, he might have someone that would let him take up bird watching, and I did that with a vengeance. And it led me to, sort of dream I'd be a biologist and I would understand bird migration, which I now would heartily recommend no one to study because it's too hard. We don't know the basic principles of how information is stored in the brain, and that's really the only interesting thing is, you know, how can you store migratory pathways in the brain? And I think that's too hard, so I would you know, it might be 100 years before the bird's brain is, you know, equal to understanding migration. It could be much sooner, but I wouldn't choose it as something. But that's what I wanted to understand, you know, how did the golden plover reach the Falkland Islands? And, you know, it was these long distances over oceans and coming right on that island. That was just, you know, seemed a miracle. And, you know, it was somehow connected to life.
I ask lots of scientists this question because young scientists are always fascinated by the way, the trajectory that people who later became well-known, celebrated, followed. And they're surprised as they stumble through midterms and finals and wonder what they're doing at the serendipity that sometimes happens in this scientific career. I mean, so you're interested in bird watching, but then how?
Well, I went to the University of Chicago.
At 15.
And then, which was based on the great books, but they allowed me soon after to become a zoology major. So I had a dual track through the university. And so I was not at all interested in genetics until there was a newspaper review in the Chicago Sun of Irving Schrödinger's book, What is Life? Mm-hmm. And the question of what is life had, you know, long interested me in that. My father was non-religious. I became non-religious at the age of 11. And what was to replace God? And what were the rules? Mm-hmm. And Schrödinger emphasized the secret essence of life had to be in the information carried in the chromosomes and on entities called genes, which in his book he assumed would be a protein because everything interesting then would be a protein. And there was the question, how did you copy the information? And somehow it was the copying problem that when Schrödinger described it as, I wanted to understand the copying problem. And that was essentially, you know, were anything but the law, current laws of chemistry necessary to explain the extreme faithfulness of the copying of the genetic message. So that was it. And so I wanted to, I think my focus on life was I certainly didn't like religion, didn't want it as an explanation, but you needed something else. You couldn't say God did it. Well, what did it? So you had to replace God with chemistry. And I think I saw that at that time, you know, there were people thinking, well, you'll replace God with physics, and there'll be some new, you know, quantum mechanic exotic chemical principles which would allow life to exist. Then my hero at that time, Max Delbruck, he certainly believed it. He thought there were going to be new laws of nature to explain life. Yeah. And I didn't. So, you know, I thought we were just good old chemistry.
Now, wasn't some early thinking of Max Delbruck's what led Schrödinger to write What
yes,
is Life?
Yes, it was.
And this book, What is Life, became a life-changing experience for a great deal of many scientists, particularly after the Second World War, particularly after a bomb goes off.
Yes.
A lot of theoretical physicists, including Francis Crick, including Leo Szilard, and so on, all then begin looking to biology.
Yes, certainly. It was influential for Francis Crick. It was influential for Morris Wilkins. I think it was also influential for Seymour Benzer, who was a physicist. Max Perutz, who was a chemist, trained as a chemist in Austria, disliked the book and just couldn't ever accept the fact that it was so influential. But that was maybe because he just assumed, you know, it was going to be chemistry. And he wasn't concerned with The Crick and I, Crick was, you know, very intensely anti-religious at that stage. I mean, you know, we both meld with age, but I mean, you know, at that stage, he wanted something else. But so it did, I'd say the book had a big impact, and it led me to decide that I wanted to understand life as opposed to bird migration, and I wouldn't go to Cornell as a graduate. And so I naturally applied to Caltech, and quite sensibly they turned me down because I'd had no, I wasn't trained in chemistry at all. I didn't have a course in physical chemistry. You know, I looked like a sort of out of place boy naturalist, which I was, except that at the University of Chicago, I'd really been taught to be serious and to sort of begin to think like a scientist. So I had very good teachers at Chicago, and that was based on more of the great books. When you got neuroscientific subject, they let you have texts, and you could get a somewhat conventional education, which I did in zoology. But it didn't look like what you would need in order to find the structure of DNA. And it then turned out that at Caltech, I would have, you know, Delbruck, the hero of the book, I didn't know he was at Caltech then, and I would have wanted to be a student. But he was an awful supervisor of students. He was just dreadful. And whereas his colleague, Salvador Luria, the Italian that they had worked together at Gulf Spring Harbor, he was wonderful with students. So I got a really good, someone interested in me. Whereas Delbruck wouldn't have been interested in me. He was, you know, he wanted physics to be important. And I sort of hoped it wouldn't be. Because, you know, that, because that would just be too much to understand.
Right. These periods in history are extraordinary in the sense that if you look back at the Solvay conferences,
yes,
with Einstein and Pauli and all, yeah, this, the physics is just in furore at that point. Yes. Then, as if you look back in the history of DNA, I mean, yes, there are all these extraordinary names around, Salvador Luria and Max Delbruck and so on and so forth. An amazing period, but you're turned down by Caltech. You somehow get to Indiana, right?
Well,
the backwoods, but then it's got Herman Muller there.
Yes, no,
and Salvador Luria. Yeah.
And Caltech really had Sturtevant, who was a boar, and most of the Drosophila people were boars. There wasn't much exciting at Caltech then, except for Linus Pauling. And you know, I would have felt so unequal to Pauling that. And he would have immediately sensed my, you know, just complete lack of knowledge. So it was better that I didn't get exposed to chemistry until I was a postdoc. And so I could really be learn genetics as a graduate student. Yes, and Indiana was just better for genetics than Caltech was.
But even while you're working on the structure of DNA, my understanding was that before you wrote the molecular biology of the gene, the, yes, big textbook,
yes,
you decided that you didn't know enough chemistry. And you went and took Linus's chemistry class.
No. I was...
Someone has
the molecular biology of the gene rose out of 10 lectures I gave to Harvard freshmen or sophomores. Mm-hmm. And when I started writing it up, I realized that you needed some background in chemistry. You needed some, mm-hmm, background. So I wrote an introductory chapter trying to put the gene in terms of the history of genetics. Then I decided, well, I had to do biochemistry. Then I had to do one on the hydrogen bonds. And then I had to do one on making covalent bonds. So I wrote these introductory chapters so the book would be understandable to people who were not chemists. you know, just to give them enough chemistry. And so I, you know, I read some textbooks, and you know, when I was at, you know, the hydrogen bond chapter, you know, our Bible when Francis and I were in Cambridge was always The Nature of the Chemical Bond. And I still treasure a copy of Pauling's Nature of the Chemical Bond. Francis gave me as a Christmas present in 1951. I mean, he knew, you know. But then the irony of it is, you know, it was all hydrogen bonds. And Francis and I, in this sort of stumbling way, just didn't think about hydrogen bonds for more than a year. And Francis was... His chemistry, he talked to the wrong chemist, and he was just moving in the wrong direction. And then suddenly, and I can't tell you why, you know, I tried to, you know, think like Pauling and put together hydrogen bonds.
How did you get from Indiana to what eventually would become the laboratory, LMB?
Well, I thought I wanted to study DNA, and I didn't really... wasn't trained in biochemistry, so I thought I'll learn, go to a place where someone is trying to make DNA in a test tube. And Kalkar had some radioactive. He was a very well-known Danish biochemist. But when I arrived there, I discovered that he wasn't going to work on DNA. And then within 2 months of getting there, he wasn't going to work at all because he had a girlfriend who was his postdoc. And so he did nothing the whole time I was there. Yeah, literally. And so I moved to a serum laboratory, which made vaccines, where a microbiologist was interested in bacterial viruses. Had been to Caltech, had been in Delbrook's lab. And so I spent a year trying to study how DNA replicated. And I won't go into it, but we got a negative result. It didn't say anything. And in the spring, a great piece of luck, Kalkar decided he wanted to, the sun of Naples would be less depressing than Copenhagen. And so we went to the biological station, Stazione, in Naples. And there, toward the end of my visit, there was a small meeting on macromolecules. And the English physicist Morris Wilkins came and showed an X-ray picture of DNA, which indicated the DNA was highly ordered sufficiently to form crystals. So immediately, wanted to work with Wilkins. I wanted, because Copenhagen was, you know, just a failure. And though in Copenhagen there were a lot of intelligent people, so it wasn't as if, you know, I was in a, you know, second-class environment. I was in a first-class environment which wasn't interested in DNA, so, you know, I left.
But Copenhagen was Niels Bohr.
Yes, that was the...
Which is why Max Delbrück,
you know, then I was invited to Bohr's house twice. And the second time was just pure torture because I was sitting next to Bohr and I didn't understand a word he said. But then I discovered the Danes didn't understand Bohr either. He was legendary for not being understood by people, which I'm sure was not true in 1925. But I was next to him. He knew I was associated with Delbrück and, you know, why I was there. And, you know, he was a gracious person, nice, but, you know, the whole dinner of just not understanding a word was, you know.
Was it boring?
Yes, yeah.
Sorry.
I would say it was boring, but, you know, Copenhagen was a beautiful city and... the little shrimp are very good, and you know they. But it was an old-fashioned place. Friday night was solidly for getting drunk. It really smashed. You started out with aquavit, and then you moved on to wine, and then you ended up after midnight with beer. But you know, after two or three aquavits, you know, everything was gone. And then, you know, you try and work on Saturday. But, boy, they drank. And
I should remind you also that one of the books Jim wrote recently, which is the subject of the conversation I had with him last time, is actually called Avoid Boring People, or Avoid Boring People, or...
Yeah, well, you know, there was a double meaning, which many people, when they see the title, just thinks I'm arrogant and I don't want to be with boring people. Whereas, in fact, you know, I've been a teacher and was very conscious that most teachers at Harvard were boring, and I didn't want to be boring. And so how do you become an unboring teacher? So it was trying to be successful. And that helped me in producing an unboring textbook. You know, really trying to... make the students like what you were saying by making it simple enough.
If you haven't read Avoid Boring People, I strongly recommend it. It has lots of the chapters end with a series of Jim's advice. Remembered lessons, I always like this bit. Choose an objective apparently ahead of its time. Work on problems only when you feel tangible success may come in several years. There's a reason. Never be the brightest person in a room.
Yes.
Why?
Well, because you don't learn anything. And both Crick and I greatly profited at times by not being the brightest person in the room. I mean, Crick needed help in mathematics, and certainly I needed help in chemistry. Francis made a mistake of finding the wrong chemist and then was misled.
Work with a teammate who is your intellectual equal.
Yes. Well, you have to have someone to talk to. Right now, you know, I miss Francis Crick. We really could talk to each other. Yeah. You know, but it was easier to... We were very much on the same wavelength.
Yeah.
You know, we were sort of really... no nonsense, no sentimentality, just what's the truth.
Well, the famous first line, I have never seen Francis Crick in a modest mood, didn't go down perfectly well to begin with, did it?
No, most people who knew Francis thought it was wonderful. No, Jacques Bonneau said I was wrong. He had once seen Francis in a modest mood when Francis made the terrible mistake of using some of his Nobel Prize winning money to buy half the interest in a yacht at Naples. And so the boat had a captain, and Francis, in the presence of people who could sail, was very modest. And, you know, quickly,
right.
Yes. So.
Always have someone to save you.
Yes, because you need some older person, because the odds are if you're trying something difficult, you're not going to succeed, but you need another chance. Mm-hmm. So you need another 2 or 3 years. And I always knew if I failed in Cambridge, Delbrook would give me a couple of years at Caltech. So I was under no tension about failing at Cambridge. You know, we didn't want Pauling to win, but I wasn't worried about my own career. But I, you know, I didn't have a wife, I didn't have children, I didn't have, you know, and I was still, you know, relatively young enough so that... I looked young, but in fact I was really pretty experienced by then.
Yeah. This is a book by Max Perutz, yes, who was running the unit in Cambridge when you arrived. One day in September 1951, a strange young head with a crew cut and bulging eyes popped through my door and asked, without saying as much as hello, "Can I come and work here?" It was Jim Watson, who wanted to join the small team of enthusiasts for molecular biology, which I led at the physics laboratory in Cambridge, England. So you've, in his best-selling book, The Double Helix, Watson mirrors himself as a brash Western cowboy entering our genteel circle. But this is a caricature, Max says.
He said that you had an
electrifying effect on them because he made us look at our problems from the genetic point of view.
Yeah, I was a useful addition because both Ken Brew and Pam Cruz, both who were extremely good scientists, had done their degrees in chemistry. So they didn't think, you know, in any way genetically.
It says here that Max seems to think that at the time you were, he said you went around like a tramp, making a show of not cleaning his one pair of shoes for an entire term. There was a sense that you were out to shock people at that time.
No, I was just someone from the Midwest. You know, so I had no veneer of civilization.
Yeah.
And, you know, the University of Chicago never gave that to anyone. I mean, we were very sophisticated, you know, with ideas. But clothes were very unimportant. And so, you know, I didn't think clothes were important. And so, you know... You know, my mother always bought me my clothes, and, you know, he didn't...
Tell me about your parents.
They were both victims of bad economic times and decisions. My father never finished college because his father, who was a stockbroker, made some bad bets and lost all his money. Mm-hmm. And my mother had money to be at the University of Chicago for 2 years and then had to get a job, and she had a rheumatic heart problem. So she got a job across the street from where she lived, and she met my father, who worked at the same company, and they married. So I had parents, who both of whom were, you could say, my father had gone 1 year to Oberlin, where he was a friend of Robert Hutchins. Hutchins was
Chicago.
A freshman at Oberlin. Then and the dominant person on the Oberlin campus when he was only 17. He was just unusual. So my father and Hutchins were friends. And I think it was at Oberlin that my father gave up his Episcopalian background. And... because he had a compulsory course in the Bible that was taught by Robert Hutchins' father, who was a Presbyterian minister from Brooklyn, mm-hmm. who afterwards became president of Berea College, which where civil rights was very... So Oberlin had a wonderful tradition of anti-slavery, and that carried forth. So my father breathed it, and there was a marvelous ornithologist named Lynn Jones. So... Mm-hmm. My father got, you know, in a sense, so he was immature. And then, you know, his mother had him learn stenography, and that when during the war he was in France, but, you know, typing the letters for the officers, so was never in the trenches. And then came back and had a job where he, you know, had a nice car and he was collecting money. But then the Depression hit and they cut his salary in half, and the car was sold. And so he had $3,000 a year. That was his salary. Yeah. And so my mother saw that my sister and I, or she herself, you know, we looked respectively middle class. We didn't look like trash, but they never borrowed a cent of money. So, you know, we might have 1 week of vacation in a rather cheap lakeside resort. That was a sort of holiday. Mm. And so we were very strong Roosevelt. My mother was a precinct captain, and I went to the Democratic Convention of 1940. So, you know, she was an Irish Democrat, and my father was intensely both pro-Roosevelt and despised Hitler. So my father was very comfortable and very much like Jewish intellectuals. Mm-hmm. And so... he found the anti-Semitism of Germany particularly repulsive.
What, going further back, what is Watson? What was Watson's Saloon?
Watson's Saloon was in Springfield, Illinois. It was where Abraham Lincoln spent the election night. It served no alcohol, but served macaroons and ice cream. My ancestor, the original Watson, was a caterer. He catered all of Lincoln's parties. And we have a copy of a check written in 1855 from Lincoln to William Weldon Watson for $106. For that was for pastries. So the movie Lincoln mentions his wife's need to entertain on a big level. And so the money went to Watson's saloon. He'd been previously a Baptist minister, so I think they were strongly anti-alcoholic. His son went on the gold rush, which earned enough money to get in the entertainment food business. But they arrived in Springfield at the same time as Lincoln, 1836. And they lived within two blocks of Lincoln and clearly knew them. And then the original William Weldon Watson had five children, a son Ben, who was the gold rush and then quite ambitious. And then a daughter, Abigail, who married the wealthiest man in town, who was then a juror, named Ives. And then he went into the grain business, became very successful. And she was the grandmother of Orson Welles. So Orson Welles was out of a Watson tradition. So I heard a lot about Orson Welles. And when I was a child, my ambition was to be a genius. And I say this in a slightly crazy way, but I wanted to do something with my brain. I wasn't going to be a musical genius. Orson was declared a genius at 18 months. He was directing plays when he was 10. He ran away with my uncle's daughter when they were 10. And so he was precocious. And I wasn't clearly precocious at all. I was a late developer, very short. But by the age of 20, suddenly I was aware that I had finally become different in the way that I wanted to be. That people like Gloria and Delbrook thought I was bright. They treated me as an equal. Mm-hmm. And that had to be, I think, just from this superb education I got at Chicago. I was really trained on the great books and, wonderful teachers. And I loved books. And, now I see myself as a product of the Protestant Reformation. If you wanted to say, what am I? I am a product of that Reformation, which made me, motivated and hardworking, and you're not lazy. You take care of the people who are less privileged. Protestant Reformation was made for people who are entrepreneurs, and I think early on, I wanted to do things and to run things. So and it turned out that's what I can do.
Well, you ended up running Cold Spring Harbor.
Well, originally it was going to fail. Now in England you've got an institution that can't fail. The Royal Society, because of Susan Greenwood's complete nonsense, is going to fail. And that building is where Faraday was.
A Royal Institution.
Yes, they've got to save the building. And, it'll only take $100 million. Mm-hmm. And then the Royal Society should run it as a place for science for the public. But, so sometimes institutions you can't fail. And Cold Spring Harbor had been, thanks to the Rockefeller Foundation during the 30s, the first place for real meetings where genetics and chemistry came together. And it had been just terribly influential on me, and I didn't want it to fail because, you know, Woods Hole was just no good compared to it. Coastal Harbor was really classy because of the quality of the courses and everything. So I became the director, then Harvard let me, you know, I said it's, you know, a third-time job or not, and I'll continue my teaching. And so they were very nice to me. And then we got, you know, we had $20,000 endowment, not much security. Before they had the money of the Carnegie Institution of Washington. So originally it was formed because of Andrew Carnegie. And then kept alive by the Rockefeller money during the Depression, in a minor way. And then after the war, NIH came in, but it wasn't sufficient just to maintain something as, you know, all the land and everything that goes through overhead. So I wanted to save it.
Right, but the reason this interests me is that there's all those, a lot of the early stuff, and the reason I mentioned Max's comment there about the way you were dressed and so on, there was this apparently disorganized person under 25 romping around. Yeah. But there was also a comment that you had the most exquisitely organized notebooks, your actual notebooks, whenever you were doing anything. So there's this other organizational thing, which then led on to your being at directing Cold Spring Harbor, which is a non-trivial enterprise, I would think.
I never thought I would be exceptionally good at anything. But at this sort of, you know, handling science and writing books. I don't know why. I never, you know, my real hope out of the Double Helix that, you know, some girl would like it and I'd get a wife. And, just simple. And I did, you know, she read the early manuscript. And so it worked that way. And it became famous as a book in its own right. I never anticipated. So I thought I had written a good book, but I never had thought that, you know, other people would. I had a marvelous story. So, and a set of characters. And so the book had to be written. I thought had to be, but then you weren't supposed to say bad things about your colleagues, or you weren't supposed to, you know, say really what happened in the genesis of a paper. And I wanted to tell the whole story, and people thought, that I was out there to shock people. No, I was just out there to tell them the story. I didn't make up any facts. I didn't, I think, bias the book in any way by wanting to be sensational. I just said it what it was. You know, Chargaff was an awful man, so I said he was an awful man. Rosalind Franklin was difficult. Okay. So, and, you know, I didn't know why. And, you know, I had become friends with Wilkins, and they couldn't stand each other, so I was on Wilkins' side. So I told it, you know, as the story happened. I didn't... afterwards, a woman at Joyce Leibovitz at Harvard Press had told me I should write a little epilogue and say what happened to people, and I wrote that. And, I explained, you know, that Rosalind died, and we'd become friends, and, you know, that I tried to put it in, end it in a better way. Originally, it wasn't that way. So, the book was going to be published by Harvard Press. They wanted, and I got, again, very good help from Harvard Press. So, not a sentence was ghostwritten, because I could the manuscripts exist. I wrote by, hand, and it's all there. And I had a sentence that... Peter Pauling sent his father the manuscript, which I hadn't intended. And Linus objected to the sentence that Linus looked like an ass. So I took it out. So that was what, you know, the, you know, good taste says don't call Pauling an ass. I didn't say he was an ass. I said he looked like an ass. So, you know, subtle distinctions. But, you know, it was basically a fun book to write, you know, to get. And I wrote very short chapters. So, you know, basically a chapter was a week's work. And there was only 25. So it was, you know, a half year's job, but it was spread over. I wrote the first chapter before we had the Nobel Prize. And then realized I was never going to finish that book until we got the prize. Because if the book had come out, Wilkins would probably not have got the prize. So we wanted Wilkins to get the prize.
So that was 62, the prize.
Yes.
And the book came out in 68. And so the book came out in 68. You mentioned your wife, Liz. There's another nice coincidence here. You spent a lot of time at the Salk Institute, of course. You knew Jacob Bronowski, who was the deputy director.
And Bronowski was a wonderful man. You know, Bronowski was Leo Szilard's successor at the Salk. Salk, Leo was, you know, the office which Bruno had, Szilard had it. But Szilard was only there a year or two. Szilard was a man I really modified and admired, because Szilard could have an idea and then get interested in the consequence of the idea. And then he had the consequence, and then he could be interested in the consequence of the consequence, and then the consequence of... So he would, Szilard would jump ahead four steps and be worried. And he was right about it. So, you know, when he had the idea of the chain reaction, he had it patented and put it in the Admiralty safe so no one could see it. He wanted the patent because he had patented some idea in refrigeration with Einstein. And but he knew. But he thought the answer was going to come from lithium. So his chemistry, you know, he wasn't thinking uranium at all. Yeah. Probably he was just, you know, lithium is simpler. So he had some reason it was going to be lithium. But Szilard was probably, of all the people, the one, you know, except for Francis, that influenced me the most.
Yeah. I want to put three little things here. Just jump topic, because, you know, people can go and buy the annotated version of the Double Helix and get masses of stories here. This is another of your books, DNA, The Secret of Life. There's a comment here, I think, in the foreword, where you say DNA has come a long way from that Saturday morning in Cambridge. However, it's also clear that the science of molecular biology, what DNA can do for us, still has a long way to go. Cancer still has to be cured. Effective gene therapies for genetic diseases still have to be developed, and so on and so forth. Cancer has been a major theme of yours throughout this period.
I can write in paper how we can cure it. You know, it might not work, but it does. You know, it's a simple idea.
But there's
inhibitor, and we know how to handle.
Let me ask you about this, because there's a simplified piece in New Scientist for the 16th of March, titled "Antioxidant Antidote: Could Antioxidant Foods and Pills Heighten the Risks of Cancer and Diabetes?" asked James Watson. And then in a piece that Sharon Begley wrote, she said, another link here, Watson's antioxidant stance includes one historical irony. The first high-profile proponent of eating lots of antioxidants, specifically vitamin C, was Linus Pauling.
Of course.
So,
That was long ago, and vitamin C, depending on its concentration, is both an oxidant and an antioxidant. So,
but are you the? Are we doing? Are we? Is this an homage to Linus?
No, it had nothing to do with it. It's just that if you have type 2 diabetes, it's crazy if you have any antioxidants.
So, what's the simple thesis here of your?
The simple thesis. And started with cancer, which is, and it'll be my lecture tomorrow, is that all the really effective anti-cancer agents do so by producing reactive oxygen species. And then the reactive oxygen species interact with the mitochondria of cells to lead to a process called programmed cell death, called apoptosis, okay? And so this has been ignored by a lot of people because they say, oh, they all act in different ways. But if you add an antioxidant, you can destroy the effect of the anti-cancer agent. So the evidence is pretty good. The other thing is, if you look, and Dave Tewson here, part of the effort was that when cells become resistant to chemotherapy, they often become resistant to everything. And this resistance is largely due to the existence of large amounts of antioxidants. Mm-hmm. So you can't treat cancer. Cancer becomes untreatable once they fill up with antioxidants. Okay. And then the question is, how do you kill a cell filled with too many antioxidants? And there the answer is nice, simple answer. But it's only partially true, and it's metformin. Okay, now metformin is a 2,000-year-old drug. Chiefly, it's the most prescribed drug in the world. It's used to fight type 2 diabetes. And they observed about 5 years ago that diabetics got less cancer. And then when they looked at it was only diabetics who took metformin. Such as there was a published paper that the frequency of pancreatic cancer, the most awful of them, is cut in half in people who are taking metformin. So then the question, how does metformin act? And then there is very nice work done at Harvard Medical School by someone who's just come here, in which they look for was there any commonly used drug for some other indication which would also kill cancer cells? And when they did this screen, the number one candidate came to be metformin. Hmm. So why? And then the other puzzling thing is that metformin seems to kill the worst of the cancer cells. The ones, it kills triple negative breast cancer much better than it does ordinary breast cancer. And it kills P53 minus much better than ordinary. So there's a paradox, which I think I will tell you the answer tomorrow. It's not my answer, but I have to say something tomorrow.
Yeah, but
but what it does do is you want to know is what is there about a cell which makes metformin kill it? And then if you have that, that leads to paper schemes by which you ought to possibly could kill cancer. So it's very fascinating. Then it turns out, you see, that type 2 diabetes is really due to an absence of reactive oxygen species. And then we had a meeting on it. Dave helped organize. And then I sort of asked myself, what do reactive oxygen species do? I mean, well, how can they prevent diabetes? And then, fortunately, because there was a good Swedish chemist at the meeting, I think the answer is that it makes disulfide bonds. So there's a syndrome called, what is it, David? Disorganized protein syndrome.
Unfolded protein.
What disorder? Yeah. Unfolded protein. Well, unfolded protein is what you have if you don't have disulfide bonds. So I think it's all fitting together. I really have a big theory.
But
all got by reading. No experiments whatsoever, just reading.
Okay, there's an interesting... the same way you came up with DNA, right?
Yes, the same way. Just use other people's data.
Which is
regarded as dishonest, but, you know, why not?
That's a nice picture you have there, Dr. Franklin.
Yes. No. It's just that most people are so busy they don't know the literature or they don't ask difficult questions.
Let me just, because I'm interested in this cycle here, because if you go back to, what, 68 or something, where Mary Lasker,
yes,
Sidney Farber, you end up advising Nixon as well. The War of Cancer comes out. I then see you being quoted as saying, it's too early, we can't do it yet. And now you're on the you're one of the founders.
Benno Schwartz removed me from the committee because I wasn't a reliable member of the committee.
I didn't want to go into that.
I went and gave the talk at the dedication of the MIT Cancer Center, and that was in May of 75. And I said that MIT should be congratulated because for the first time the cancer money was being used in an intelligent way. You should bring cancer to brain people with brains instead of sick people in the hospital. That is, cancer should be, put in the hands of someone brighter than doctors. And it's not that doctors are inherently stupid, but they're not scientists. And yet they run the big hospitals. And so I congratulated, and I didn't think anyone's speech, and then it was in the Washington Post, and, it didn't look very good. But what I was saying is that the war on cancer, we didn't know enough about cancer to build hospitals. We had to learn more. That's all I was saying, and trying to, praise MIT and praise my host. And instead it came out as an attack on the National Cancer Body, which deserved it because it was run by, it was run by a Texan, Benno Schmidt. He was with J.H. Whitney, a very powerful man, very likable. You could hardly dislike Benno, but he didn't know a goddamn thing. And, was making decisions and was trying, as an investment banker, he wanted friends. And so you have the medical community like you, and it was just too premature. I didn't know it was going to be 40 years, but, it's been really now 40 years. And I think we finally know enough, and I don't want to criticize anyone for not curing cancer even 10 years ago. I think now we've got enough clues that we might just do it. And I've written, I think biomedical research is in deep shit unless we cure cancer. We've been talking about it for so long that we've got to deliver. And, the physics community, I pointed out, if they hadn't found the Higgs boson, their money was gone. And they spent 20 years, they built the big machines, they did it all correct, and they found it. And all I'm saying is the public wants us to succeed. And if you don't succeed after 40 years, they begin to wonder.
Yeah. Why would you pick a subject? So you're one of the founding people on the Lustgarten Foundation for Pancreatic Cancer Research. I did some filming some years ago and met David Tuberson. Who's now at Cold Spring Harbor Lab. Yeah. Dave works on pancreatic cancer. That has always struck me as being a really difficult. Is the plan to confront pancreatic cancer at this point?
We're going to win.
Okay.
No. I'm just saying, if you don't think you're going to win, you better get out. But I don't think, we're doing it because we have to say that. In fact, when I say it, everyone looks uncomfortable, as long as we say it's going to occur 10 to 20 years from now, we're never accountable. And that's generally the state. It's always going to happen 10 to 20 years from now. It takes 10 years to develop a new drug. Down the line. That's why I like metformin. It's existed for 2,000 years. In a crude form. And so I think we've made enormous progress. And, if we understand the unfolded protein thing, that's big. I rate things as big as whether they would warrant a half page of my textbook. Something that should go in a solid textbook. And I've worn a page and a half now. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I'm right. You know, I'm feeling so good, I must appear arrogant. But, you know, I'm actually, you know, boy, I've been in this war for so long. I taught a course at Harvard, 1959. So I, you know, I'm cancer. I had 5 students, not many. But, you know, I really wanted to understand it. And, you know, it was always too difficult. But, you know.
At that
life is difficult enough. But if we can get rid of, understand diabetes and understand, Alzheimer's is the one that scares me. Because at 85, it should scare anyone, 85. And because half the people who are 90 are some dementia. And I think we're going to...
You had your genome sequence, but you didn't want to know about the APOE4.
Yeah, it wouldn't have told me anything because it's a gene next door that probably kills you. And there are a variety of reasons they wouldn't... it wouldn't have told me anything, but I saw no... reason of knowing bad news without knowing how to counter it. I have enough things to worry about. I mean, you know, Republicans down the line. I mean, you know, a lot of things to worry about. And so I'm not going to worry about, you know, whether I get Alzheimer's, you know. But now I'm convinced that exercise really is preventing it. I mean, it's a lot of literature that the people who exercise and, you know, get less. And I exercise 3 times a week, and I don't know whether I should exercise more or less. But I think we make exercise real science.
Are you still playing tennis?
What?
You're still playing tennis?
I play singles tennis. Yeah, I realize that I want to get myself photographed playing tennis so that people will believe that I actually can hit the ball. Otherwise, it's unbelievable when I say I'm playing singles tennis against a 25-year-old former Swedish junior champ. Yeah, it sounds unlikely.
Last time you told me that your forehand had been measured at 100 miles an hour.
Oh, I have a very good forehand. No, my backhand is weak. No, I do not have a great backhand, but I have a great drop shot. But, you know, someone like Nadal could handle that. You know, it won't work against a good player, but someone who isn't very good, it works.
What's your advice to a young scientist?
Most important thing is to know more than other people. Just know the facts. You know, if you're in business, you want to know more facts than else. You know, is this company good or bad, or is their product out of date? And, you know, it's knowledge. I mean, you know, basic brains helps, but brains without knowledge doesn't help. Mm. And so I would say most people don't spend enough time being broad and reading. And I guess the second advice I would have is only work on something that is important. And those PhD theses are so unimportant.
Yeah, but how do you know?
What?
How do you know what's important?
Oh, sometimes. Oh, look, you can walk down a corridor and just know it's bad science. No, you can't. I mean, there's some things which are just going nowhere. And you just avoid it. And, you know, you can go to MIT, you can either, you know, the only place at MIT you can be sure of real quality is the Whitehead. It's really good there. And but even in the Whitehead, you know, there would be people, you know, who are younger or something that you pick. I was lucky. Luria was 35, I was 20.
Yeah.
And I was his only graduate student. So, you know... So my advice was, you know, work on a new topic with a young thesis advisor. Don't work with anyone famous because they won't have time for you. And, but the most important, you know, both Francis and I see PhD theses turned out to be unimportant. I didn't realize it, you know, until I was getting near the end, that it wasn't anything. Francis always knew what he was doing, but he was more a theoretician, and it, as an experimentalist, he should just stay away from it.
Yeah.
You know, always, and you know, this last piece of, never be the brightest person in the room. Go to a place where you can learn. Have bright colleagues. And, you know, which generally means you want to go to Caltech or you want to go to MIT or, you know, you want to go to a place where the people are good. And you can learn from them. After a while, you have to realize that even the good people don't know anything either. You know, they don't really know what to do the next month. It's very hard. And but that's when you grow up, when, you know, you realize you've got to think by yourself. You can't rely on other people's. And it takes a couple of years, generally, for most people. But, you know, fortunately, you know, there are a lot of very good places in the United States and now in Europe where you can do very good science.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a problem in the United States is just this money problem, which is that is, you know, your future economic prospects seem bleak if you have no resources. And
well,
it didn't bother me, but I think I was so young, I didn't, you know. I didn't have to support my parents, and I didn't have to,
right.
You know, carry on. And we would, you know.
All right. So the president, when he came into office, said we will restore, his administration would restore science to its rightful place. Didn't give any coordinates. What is the rightful place of science? I mean, you obviously believe in the communication of it. You do it all the time.
I sort of have a feeling we're not going to get much more from the government. Well, one is the United States government is broke. I think unless we have more enlightened citizens, Sprode, we're in really deep problems. We get some help from Jim Simons, which is very important to us. But I think the great wealth has got a... and I'm not intending to, a disproportionate amount of our nation's money now, and it has to be redistributed in some way. And I think redistributing it toward academia is the most efficient way of ensuring the success of the country and training people. So we're going to really have to, you know, and, you know, it didn't, you know, cheer me up when Warren Buffett said he was giving his money to Bill Gates. I mean, you know, that just seems, you know, can't you think for yourself? And, no, it's more or less the more different people doing it, the more diverse will be the aid. And we don't need Bill Gates-like sums. We need smaller sums in different places with supporting other ideas. But I think without... that American academia is going to be in a very bad situation for at least a decade.
Right, but in terms of science, here's one topic that I do a lot about on the Science Network, and I'm curious to know what you think about this. The 7 March cover of Nature was all about women in science. Science for all, most of us are biased. Mind the gender gap. Have you... I mean, you've said stuff on this before. Have you mellowed?
No.
No.
You know, I haven't met any woman that's as good as Francis Crick. Now, admittedly, I haven't met any men, so you can say... you know, it's not saying something, but I think they're... it has to be a certain ruthless, almost desire to run things that's necessary for success at a big level. You know, you know, we want the supply and power. So, you know, you do it. And I think the male psyche is more attuned to battles. Whereas Rosalind Franklin gave up her battle. You know, she was with Wilkins. She gave it up. You know, if she was a man, she wouldn't have given it up. You know, man would die rather than give it up.
But wouldn't you?
So that's all I'm trying to say. Increasingly, I hear very good talks by women at Cold Spring Harbor. Yeah. So they certainly have been kept from doing science, very high-grade science. Whether they should, you know, would be an equal number of sort of very unusual male. Most of the failures in this world are men. And I like to believe that we deserve a few real winners. Hmm. You know. And so the truth, you know, we should find out the truth. To find out the truth, we have to give lots of responsibility to women. You know, we've had a lot of dismal male presidents of Harvard. Now, you know, the current woman is not going to be any better than the men. So it's only when a woman really is better than a man that you say, boy, they've made it.
Yeah.
And time will tell.
Yeah, my personal suspicion is that, like...
But, you know, Nature is such a crappy magazine now. I mean, it's awful. Yes. You know, I mean, Phil Campbell was a second-class mind. I mean, John Maddox was a wonderful, bright man, and we've got this mediocrity giving us these pompous editorials every week. I don't think anyone reads them.
This is Mario Capecchi, who's a Nobel laureate that you all know, speaking at Cold Spring Harbor for a celebration. He still is confrontational. He says outrageous things, often just to get a reaction.
No,
but
because
then he goes
that's
on,
the
but
truth.
Then he goes on to say he makes remarks that are usually right on the money. My personal thesis is that you've been saying these things about women just to drive more of them into science.
No. No. No, not at all. I mean, I've had some very good women scientists working for me. I don't think they've ever in any way felt I've thwarted their career or haven't given them good advice. And but basically, I like women who think like men, which means they're slightly unfeminine. That's all. And so, you know, I like tough men.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying.
So here's a question. If I gave you a time travel token, which allowed you to bring to your dinner table anybody from any discipline, from any period of history, and sit down and have a conversation with them, who would you like to chat to?
Oh, by now, pretty obvious, Darwin.
Yeah,
I mean, just to, you know, tell Darwin everything that had happened since he died. So, you know, and clearly he was extremely intelligent.
Yeah.
But his intelligence was developed rather late. I mean, he wrote these marvelous books after The Origin of Species. So he was very intelligent. So he would be the person that, you know, I would like to speak
to. You could also have had a great conversation about birds. And I meant...
No, but birds don't interest me much more. You know, it's really diabetes interests me, or, you know, I think they're...
Yeah. All right. So, yeah. So what are you optimistic about?
We finally know what's wrong with diabetes, too. That's a big step forward. Unfolded proteins. Okay. No, it's not proven, but at least, you know, explains a lot. And if Alzheimer's is related to it, now they're calling it diabetes 3. You know, Alzheimer's is it's very frightening to think about unless you know what's up. And, you know, all we've heard is fights. Is it plaques or is it tangles? It's neither. But unfolded proteins tangle and they plaque. So I think that's probably going to be the answer. So I think, you know, sometimes it's sort of, you take all the evidence, it just, Francis used the word, it smells right. You know, there's somehow, you know, it's seemingly coming together. You're not forcefully putting together things which really don't fit. It looks like they might fit. So I'm, you know, we have to control Alzheimer's. And diabetes, you know, there's Mayor Bloomberg's way, which I would do if I were mayor, but then you would, you know, hope that you can have a medicine which would still let Coca-Cola be, you know, serve these awful drinks. You know, because, you know, I'm against laws unless you really feel that you're going to go to hell without them. And in this case, I'm afraid, you know, New York City just gets too sick. And, you know, it can't handle it. So in that case, you know, I'm in favor of laws, but not, you know, and probably, you know, in many cases you don't have it. The law should cease to exist after 20 years. There should be, and then you can put them into order if they're really serving a function.
So cancer is now primary on your agenda?
Of course, because if we cure cancer, Congress is going to like us. Very simple. You know, have they any reason to like us? No, they could say all we've done is increase the cost of medical care through, you know, and all these new diseases that are being invented by the companies, new medicine. I mean, it's remarkable. You know, toenails fall off. I mean, anything. You know, it's a charge lot of some money. And, you know, we should, you know, we might be able to afford 10%, but we can't afford 25% of, you know, the national budget going toward health, or there'll be nothing. We'll have no highways. We'll have nothing. Our affluent highways, the potholes are awful. Yeah, you know, it doesn't look like Beverly Hills, I'll tell you that. So the country is, in some sense, falling apart, and I think we have to win on things which will, you know, like cutting medical costs. So, you know, but I think we're going to win. You know, as long as we can preserve our prestige universities like this one and Caltech and Stanford and maintain, you know, say 50 good universities in our country. I think you need about that level. It's not clear to me you gain much by going from 50 to 100. I mean, in terms of generating scientific progress.
Yeah, but a lot of it's the way in which people communicate, isn't it? Because one of the things about the LMB, and there's been studies done on this, you are all fairly closely jammed together. You are talking to each other all the time. Cold Spring Harbor was another place where people interacted all the time. Current director Bruce Stillman's here as well. I assume you keep it... people chatting to each other still. There's a lot of conversation in the lab that I'm in. There's 3:30 every day. There's a tea time. I mean, people talk. So they have to be together, don't they? I mean,
yes. I think also, though, you know, one's criticized. If you stay at home, it's really a death spiral. You've got to travel. You have to go to other places because at any given time, the most exciting thing is not what's being done in your place, but in some other place. And you, the sooner you know it, the better off you can change your agenda. So I think traveling is, you know, I would say, you know, if I was really an active scientist, you know, I'd be in London 3 times a year. I'd be in California 6 times a year. And just to, you know what's up. That is maybe 2 weeks ahead. But, you know, that's one. And that's why I come back. It needs a man to want to do that sort of crap. I mean, you know, it's a brutal life.
It's a brutal life?
No, I mean, traveling and working. I mean, it's really hard.
Well, except that, I mean, we actually do have to wrap up, apparently. But One of the things that you get from reading your book initially, which set the trend, but then any other books about the Human Genome Project or many other things in science, instead of it sounding like this sort of staid people, you know, at benches, diligently working away, it's quite clear that a lot of there's a great deal of this catfighting goes on. I mean, it's a very busy and squabbly and vibrant and profound. Yeah, it's not boring.
No, it's not boring, but it's hard work. I'm not saying it's... I'm just saying being a scientist at your peak really means that you work hard. You can't relax much. Mm-hmm. That's all. And so you got to be lucky enough, you know, that you've got a good body's in shape, and you know. But I've been feeling, my life is pretty hard. You know, trying to get exercise, trying to do everything. I'm really tired at night. And it doesn't lead you to sleep more, I tell you. You know, you just worry about what it is you're worrying about.
What do you do to relax? I mean, do you like art? Do you like music?
Yes, I like art a lot. But, you know, I...
David Hockney painted you, apparently.
Yeah. And,
or painted a portrait of you. I'm sorry.
No, he painted he did a drawing of us after I had arranged that he was going to do a drawing of Crick and I, and it was all set. And then Hockney got sick, and it never happened. And a couple of years later, I was in London and could go to Hockney's studio. He says, "I want to draw you," and then it happened. That's what it was. He by this stage is very experienced. He gave me 2 Xerox copies, unsigned, and so I felt very pleased with it. But I realized the truth is when I got the catalog from his dealer when I'm for sale for $20,000, and of course I had to buy myself. So, but, you know, they gave me a quote, 10% discount, but, you know, it was still $18,000, but I figured, you know, that's better than, you know, it's a solid, safe investment.
In yourself?
No, in Hockney. I mean, I enormously have liked Hockney, you know, for 30 years.
You're going to do more about this, the antidote stuff, in the lecture tomorrow?
Yeah, I sort of said, no, I just think it's very interesting that, this, in particular, if I were diabetic, don't eat prunes. Prunes are the worst source of antioxidants. They're nasty things anyways, but I mean... You could imagine all these people taking prunes because they think they're good for themselves. No, it's very ironical. You could think, you could just see Jay Leno with this topic.
Well, there's really nowhere to go from there. So I'm just going to remind you of that quote of Lou Thomas's, "The capacity to blunder slightly is the real marvel of DNA. Without this special attribute, we would still be anaerobic bacteria, and there would be no music." But, so thanks to Jim for some of the music.
But I would like to say humans have to blunder too. And blundering is often the way you get where you want to be. Well, so you've got to be prepared to blunder.
Well, the music is up. Shall we blunder off stage now?
Yeah.
Okay. Jim, off.